Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, back at you for another installment of Murder and Madness and Mayhem, this time covering the strange, untimely death of Judy Smith, a 50-year-old nurse from Newton, Massachusetts. On April 10th, 1997, after allegedly accompanying her husband Jeffrey on a business trip to Philadelphia, Judy disappeared and was subsequently designated a missing person by law enforcement until, almost inexplicably, her body was discovered 5 months later on September 7, 1997, partially buried within the confines of Pisgah National Forest in Asheville, North Carolina. A forensic examination, in combination with Judy's autopsy, revealed she was the victim of a vicious stabbing. To this day, however, nobody knows who committed the crime or even what the motive might have been. Beyond that, how did Judy Smith end up along hiking trails in North Carolina when she actually vanished from the streets of Philadelphia? Just considering that fact makes us wonder if she was ever there. Now, this case has been covered elsewhere and by numerous sources, but for the most part, they've done little more than scratch the surface with analysis that doesn't get us any closer to the truth. I can't tell you exactly who killed Judy Smith. I don't read minds. But what I can do is reconstruct a psychological narrative conducive to understanding why, and also how, this incident transpired. At the very least, that will give us a basic profile of the person who wielded the knife. So Jeffrey Smith is an attorney and needs to attend a convention in Philadelphia starting on April 10, 1997. His wife, Judy, is scheduled to travel with him and substitute her husband's daytime sessions with her own sightseeing around town. Now, Judy, while she's supposedly flown many times, has only taken one trip on a plane since the change 18 months earlier that dictated travelers had to show ID at the airport to board a plane. So perhaps because of that fact, or even intentionally because she had a different agenda not involving her husband, Judy Smith forgets her driver's license. She's unable to board the plane. And with that, Jeffrey goes alone. Judy apologizes profusely and does the self-deprecating dance of saying how stupid she is, but we don't know to what degree this performance is genuine. That's where I think most analysis of this case goes awry. People feel like they need to engage in a guessing game to reveal the truth. But really, we just need to examine the emotional values at play to get a better understanding of what seems to be happening. In and of itself, this incident of getting on the plane or not getting on the plane doesn't tell us much. Maybe she forgot. Maybe she didn't. We don't know. But if the pattern repeats at a later point and does so in a manner that seems intentional, we will then understand this action is likely intentional. And if the emotional values are consistent between them, we'll know for sure. So, from the start, it's worth noting there isn't any evidence anybody interfered with Judy's well-being, and that the story about her being at the airport is a hoax. We don't have any reason to believe she wasn't there. With today's technology, that answer would be easily accessible. But for whatever reason, in 1997, we seem to have neither security footage nor eyewitness accounts of that day at the airport. So nobody actually corroborates Jeffrey's assertion that Judy was in fact at the airport and intending to board the plane. But then again, who would? If you're traveling as a couple, the rest of the people in the airport are probably strangers. Sometimes you run into people you know at the airport, and other times you don't. So, I don't think there's anything strange about this circumstance in terms of Jeffrey warranting strong suspicion. In truth, he's morbidly obese and dies in 2005, only 8 years later, due to related health issues. This isn't the type of man who can pull off the perfect murder alone. He would probably drop dead, to be honest. It's that simple. This is a crime if he pulled it off starting at home and ending up at elevation in a hiking area of North Carolina that would require strength, stamina, endurance, and adaptability. This man had none of those things. He'd been married before, and his wife Judy had been married twice prior to this marriage. These clearly weren't the types whose minds would first turn to murder in the case of marital problems. The record seems to show they're willing to divorce. Now, Judy is at least somewhat in the same boat in terms of her physical health. She's also significantly overweight, though not inhibited in the same way her husband is, but she suffers from severe arthritis in one knee, a detail which helps her remains get identified at a later time. Now, there are people who suggest their marriage wasn't perfect, and it's likely they were having problems, but there doesn't seem to have been any type of pattern of physical or verbal abuse present. Given that they had been married 5 times between the two of them, it's perfectly reasonable to believe they were simply just those types of people. Some get married once, others multiple times, and even some never marry at all. So, to the best of our knowledge, Jeffrey wouldn't be inclined to murder his wife, and accordingly, there's no evidence that he did. That doesn't mean some sort of hitman scenario couldn't develop with additional information down the road. But for now, let's assume he didn't explode and kill her prior to this trip, because we don't have any evidence to suggest that happened. It's contrary to their dispositions, the physical evidence, and even the emotional narrative. So speaking of that emotional narrative, that's what we need to evaluate here. Let's ask ourselves, what are they literally about to do when they go to the airport? They're about to take flight. In what manner will this couple do that? Together. They will take flight together, just like a husband and wife would in their marriage. When they land, they'll be together on their getaway in Philly. So, from practical and rational standpoints, it makes perfect sense for the two of them to travel together. They're both going to the same place and staying in the same hotel. But from a psychological standpoint, if someone is experiencing an emotional breakdown with her failing marriage at the forefront of her concerns, leading to a state of psychosis perhaps, or even bipolar behavior, the emotional value at play in taking flight together will trump the rational value. So if Judy is suffering from mental illness and unable to fix her problems by way of emotional change, she's going to allow them to manifest in the material world with symbolic values offering us a roadmap. For her brain, at that time, she desperately wants to get away, not only from her psychological issue, but from her marriage with her husband, which she believes is the root of it. So she manipulates a situation that satisfies the emotional value at play in the action, rather than allowing the physical value to transpire naturally, as it normally would. She emotionally refuses to take flight with her husband. She needs to get away, alone. To satisfy the emotional value, Judy must take flight from Boston without Jeffrey in a physical sense, because it's manifesting. But in order to do that, she must offer him a rational excuse. The forgotten driver's license suffices. And notice the symbolism present there. If you forget your driver's license, what does that say you don't have? Your identity. Judy wants to lose this identity. And notice how conservative that action is. It isn't suspicious. It's just enough to manipulate a circumstance in which she won't take flight or get away with Jeffrey. She'll get to do it alone. I think that's what most people are missing in this case. Judy didn't disappear from her husband's narrative of being at the convention. She was always on her own journey and veered into his only when necessary to legitimize the perception of her stated intentions, until which time she could separate completely. We see that happen in an efficient fashion. I believe, just from a cursory examination of the early events, that we're dealing with a mentally ill woman who's been hiding her psychological troubles and is now on the verge of physically requiring herself to get away to compensate for not being able to do so emotionally. Undoubtedly, it affected her marriage, and in the absence of recognizing her ailment, or even just being unwilling to seek treatment, her husband became just one of many things in her life from which she decided she needed separation, whether her intention was a short break or permanent. To my eyes, this is clearly a sick person fleeing an increasingly unstable psychological disposition by indulging the symbolic emotional value present in physical movement. She wants the emotional satisfaction of flying, of getting away without her husband, even at the practical and rational cost of having to circumvent any and all forms of convenience and efficiency along the way. Now, it might seem as though I'm hastily drawing that conclusion, but watch the same pattern of behavior continue. Jeffrey flies alone and arrives during the day. Judy, by excusing herself from the earlier flight, creates a situation in which she doesn't arrive until later that night, and is therefore not obligated to spend very much time with her husband before going to bed. When he gets up the next morning and wants to go to breakfast downstairs, she stays in bed and says she wants to sleep. So he leaves, eats, returns to the room, and guess what? Where is his wife? In the shower. And what does she know? He has to be at his first session for the convention any minute now, so he's not able to hang out. He doesn't actually get to spend any time with her. He leaves. So we have the benefit of hindsight to see a pattern was developing. If Judy was avoiding her husband and wanted to take flight from him at all costs, it was going to happen, and of her own volition. The psychological narrative documents a person trying to get away, and not somebody who was taken by force somehow. At least, at this point. Foul play certainly enters the picture when it's all said and done, but for now, if we boil down Judy's desire to one word, what is she seeking, whether we consider that notion from a psychological or physical vantage point? Freedom. She's looking for freedom. And I know some people like to think these observations I offer are just for fun and not correlated to fact. But guess what, people? Take a guess where Judy Smith tells her husband she's planning to go that day. To see the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. At the core of those physical entities, what emotional value displays its colors so proudly and beyond anything else? Freedom, of course. Judy Smith is about to physically go looking for freedom from her emotional ailments. The emotional narrative says she isn't coming back, and she doesn't. The Liberty Bell, Independence Hall, these things have meaning for her beyond historical value. On an emotional level, for her, these are talismans along her journey. They all speak specifically to freedom. And of course, you know, it probably isn't a coincidence that after this event, when it fails and she doesn't actually find the physical freedom she's seeking, she flees to higher ground. Her home, near Boston, is just above sea level. Philly is also just above sea level. Yet where do we find Judy at the end of her journey? She's dressed in hiking gear in a mountainous area of a national forest near a city that's over 2,000 feet in elevation. I don't know how high the hiking trail was, but certainly it was even higher than that. So she was on an impossible physical journey away from her home, her husband, and everything in her mind that ailed her. Nobody can seem to identify a reason why Judy would voluntarily want to go to Asheville. It isn't a destination she had on her list, so to speak. She didn't talk about it. But like I said, in her mind, she's going to have to physically seek higher ground to keep accommodating not drowning emotionally. And for an obese person with severe arthritis in one knee, early April in the northeastern part of the country is a bad time to go climbing. The cold would stiffen the knee, and snow or other adverse weather conditions could make hiking much more difficult. So for ease of travel, heading south would be ideal at that time of year. And quite frankly, North Carolina is just about exactly as far as you'd need to go to avoid the nasty stuff like blizzards. So, for me, there isn't much mystery as to why Judy would travel there. I think the most difficult aspect of this case is identifying the perpetrator. So, we need to do a few things first. Let's confirm Judy was actually at the hotel in Philadelphia, and Jeffrey isn't lying about that. And then we'll reconstruct the events as Jeffrey recalls them. So, Jeffrey goes to his first session downstairs at the convention. He's confirmed as having been there, and says his only contact with his wife that morning was before breakfast when she asserted she wanted to go back to sleep, and then he talked to her very briefly again after breakfast when she was in the shower. That exchange was supposedly short, consisting mostly of Jeffrey saying the breakfast was great, and Judy replying with a joke that she should just go downstairs naked to eat. So, according to Jeffrey, this is the last time he talks to her. While she's still in the shower, he heads down to the first session of the day at the convention. Now, look what's also going on here, aside from Judy avoiding spending time with Jeffrey. By taking a separate flight and changing her travel plans when he's not around, she prevents him from being able to realize she's preparing to do something else. If she purchased another flight when changing her travel plans, or even bought a bus ticket, Jeffrey simply would not have any way of knowing that. Likewise, when he comes back after breakfast, the only information she allows him is that she's taking a shower. He doesn't walk in and see her packing a separate bag or doing something suspicious. From start to finish on this journey, up to this point, Judy hasn't allowed her husband even an inkling of her intention. So Jeffrey goes down to the convention, and as far as we know, Judy finishes her shower, gets dressed in the same clothes she took off prior to it, and which she'd worn the day before, and then leaves the hotel without her suitcase, carrying only a red backpack. Now, most backpacks are not red, so this identifying factor will be helpful moving forward. As somebody who grew up in Philly, I can tell you Judy Smith has a common look for that region of the country that would likely have her confused with another person. And that happens, so let's take a look. First of all, we have to ask, would Judy pack a suitcase of fresh clothes only to shower and get dressed again in the ones she wore the day prior? On the surface, that might seem odd, but her family and friends, along with Jeffrey, suggest she did such things on a regular basis. Initially, the police found this detail quite suspicious, but the corroboration of other parties led them to believe Judy had actually been there and that her husband didn't just plant the suitcase to make it seem as though she traveled to Philly. Now, we have two people at the hotel, including one guest and one staff member, who remember seeing Judy. Of course, just as we witnessed in the Oslo Plaza case, these sightings could be a mistake, as we're talking about a crowded hotel during a convention. The people claiming to see Judy were not people who knew her, but those who were asked, "Have you seen this woman?" So, I don't think we can fully rely upon the information provided by these witnesses, as neither sighting offers specificity. These people didn't interact with her directly, and so they couldn't say, "Oh yes, I remember that woman with the red backpack who arrived in the same clothes she left in the next day." Witnesses at the hotel couldn't offer that, or anything similar. So, at this point, we don't truly know if she was at the hotel. Now, apparently, her trip around town that day, while it would take her to the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, was going to begin on a tour bus called the Philly Flash. Now, they're at the Doubletree Hotel in Center City, so the loop Judy would have to take on the Flash is one that goes east from Center City, heading toward I-95, which borders the Delaware River, and effectively ends the route, at which point the bus turns around and goes back the other way. There you have it. Bingo. Look what the Philly Flash does if you are experiencing the physical manifestation of your emotional issue. It does a loop, very specifically, which is actually the physical representation of insanity, meaning you keep doing the same thing over and over again without actually ever arriving anywhere different with new circumstances. It isn't change. It mimics the emotional values of a depressive cycle. So, when Judy is riding this loop, seeking freedom, aka the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, but then the journey is just going to take her right back to where she started, like it always does, to her husband and her old life, to the place from which she really wants to escape, guess what she's going to do? In order to change emotionally, you have to change the vicious cycle of your faulty behavior. But to do that in the context of the physical manifestation of your emotional issues, what would be the next step? Easy. You get off the bus. You get off the loop. You physically get out of the depressive cycle. The loop is going to take you back to your problems, back to your marriage you don't want to be in anymore. Judy's brain is recognizing this loop as a metaphor describing the emotional situation in which she is trapped. She's looking for physical solutions like flying away without her husband, aka taking flight alone, not having breakfast with him or spending any other time together, and going to see things that symbolize freedom. Now, in our world, the water's edge has always been a very powerful physical representation of the human misery of being grounded, and simultaneously the hope of emotional weightlessness, aka freedom, that water offers indirectly through its physical properties. It allows us to float. In it, we are always lighter. The water's edge is a place in which we are grounded, but from which we set sail on a journey to somewhere new. We leave behind the feeling of being grounded or stuck and go where the wind may take us, lighter than we've ever been. All of which is to say, it symbolizes leaving your problems behind. There's a reason vacationing at the water's edge in summer is the most popular destination for human beings seeking to travel for pleasure. The sun can be found everywhere. You could get a tan lying on the sidewalk outside your home. If you want to soak in water, you can just fill your bathtub. If you want a drink, you can just pour yourself one. But the reason you still want to spend a lot of money to go to the water's edge to do these things is the emotional value provided by the physical properties. We all do what mentally ill people do in terms of our desires manifesting, but the healthy brain indulges it for what it is. For instance, you and I go to the beach, stay at a resort, get fat and drunk, and come home a week or two later because we understand it won't solve our problems. We're simply looking for a little respite from everyday life. A fantasy. Meanwhile, if you're descending into psychosis, those physical properties take on a literal meaning and seem to allow long-term solutions when it's only a facade. You and I know it's a facade. When we go on vacation, we live in a fantasy life that's fueled by cash, one that isn't even remotely sustainable for most people, and then we come home with great memories. Those memories help to sustain us in difficult times. If work or home life gets tough, we think, I need to get away like last time. I need a break. We all have seen the pictures on social media with the caption, "Take me back." But for you, the emotional distress isn't significant to an extent. You need to see this event as something more than it is. We often joke while on vacation that we're never coming back, but we do that in jest because we know it isn't real life. We pay large sums of money to have people cater to us, allowing us to pretend life is easy. And we joke because we know it's not sustainable. We're going to have to come home, back to reality, when it's over. But that's okay because you got away from work. You got refreshed. You got away from having the kids down your throat every second of the day. It gave you a break. You're ready to tackle that task again. It's simple. But for someone who's suffering severe mental illness, their expectation is that these geographical movements, manipulations, and facades used to allow short-term comfort at a high price are actually intended to be permanent solutions to what ails them. And that's scary because they arrived in that place for lack of an emotional solution. When the brain can't find a psychologically viable method for emotional change, as a last resort, it will employ manifestations of those values to throw up a sign to other humans that this person has gone way off the rails. Now, the brain does that because the person in question is beyond the point of being able to help herself, and in other cases, the person is dangerous. So the brain is hoping that this irregular behavior will intuitively key people who encounter her into the fact that she needs help. However, the person still has free will. So what happens is that the brain leaves clues through symbolism and metaphor, and does so by way of utilizing Judy's physical choices to create an emotional narrative. She can go where she likes and do what she prefers without interference from her mind, but the safety valve offered by nature, in terms of understanding what happened in the aftermath, is that she's designed to seek physical properties related to emotional values. So for her, the plane literally means taking flight from her emotional problems. The trip to the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall is literally a road to freedom. And the loop she encountered on the Philly Flash, near the water's edge, signified a return to the depressive cycle of her marriage and related emotional problems. She had reached a place psychologically that prevented her from being able to return physically. She was drowning. And since the physical manifestation of your emotional problems as a long-term solution is guaranteed to fail, tragedy awaits. Once she gets off that bus, realizing she's drowning emotionally and can't go back to her husband, aka the loop, and her problems at the hotel, what's the only way to escape those rising emotional waters? You must seek higher ground. Look what happens. The next time we actually catch up to this woman, we learn she suffered a tragic death while hiking at elevation. Seeking higher ground physically when she needed to do so emotionally is what killed her, regardless of the perpetrator who wielded the knife. So let's figure out what happened when Judy got off the bus. For me, this is easy as pie. I know this area so well, I understood what happened just by placing myself in her head and allowing the emotional desire of arriving at the water with no way to set sail to freedom. And the facts actually prove I'm right. So let's take a look. If you arrive at the water's edge and have no way to set sail, while the loop promises to take you back to exactly the place from which you came, you get off. You stand there, look at the water, and what do you realize lies on the other side? Land. It's a river between, but you can see New Jersey right in front of your face. And how do you get there? All you need to do is cross a bridge. Now consider the emotional value of a bridge in comparison to its physical properties. What does it do? It allows passage from the place you are currently to the place you would rather be. You and I know we can't fix our problems by crossing a bridge to get to the other side. But if we were experiencing severe psychological distress, such as psychosis or bipolar disorder, to an extent we went off the rails due to inability to find an emotional solution, a bridge would appear to us as a physical conduit allowing passage from the place we are currently to the place we would rather be. In this case, when you cross a bridge from Philadelphia into Camden, or even into any other town across one of the many bridges along that stretch of river, you're going from one state to the next, meaning from Pennsylvania to New Jersey. But for Judy, she believes freedom lies on the other side of the bridge, or river, in the context of her mental state. So what we should see is that she goes across a bridge into New Jersey, yet doesn't find the freedom she seeks, of course, and continues her journey elsewhere and desperately because she's drowning. So what does she look for? Higher ground. And if you're a middle-aged person who's significantly overweight and hampered by a bad case of arthritis in one knee, you're not going to think, you know, I should go north and climb Mount Washington in a blizzard. What's more likely is that you'll head south to where conditions will be more conducive to success in early April. And again, North Carolina is just about as far as you'd need to go to get what you were seeking. 2,000 feet of elevation in North Carolina in April is feasible for someone heavy whose knee would stiffen in cold weather. That's not enough altitude at that time of year to make the trek really difficult. So like I said, Judy disappears at some point during the day when she says she's going on an excursion to the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall. Jeffrey is waiting for her back at the Doubletree in Center City. There's a cocktail party going on at 6 p.m. in relation to the convention in which Jeffrey is not only attending, but acting as a moderator. Yet, Judy doesn't arrive. Jeffrey mingles around the entrance to the event waiting for her, and then starts going back and forth between there and the room to see if she's returned. This is pre-cell phone for the most part, 1997. They definitely did exist, but most people weren't carrying them yet. Their popularity would of course skyrocket over the next couple of years, but for now, these people have no way to contact each other directly. Soon enough, Jeffrey starts to think something is wrong, unless they had a miscommunication of some sort about the time she was supposed to return. He asks the concierge at the front desk of the hotel to call local hospitals, thinking Judy might have stopped to help someone else, as she was known to do, or worse, she fell victim to an accident or foul play. But that person has no success. Meanwhile, Jeffrey leaves the party and rides the Philly Flash tour bus, as he was aware his wife planned to take that route. He looks at the stops along the way, but doesn't see her anywhere. It's at this point he calls the police, but they tell him he needs to wait 24 hours to file a missing persons report. Dissatisfied with that, Jeffrey locates Mayor Ed Rendell, along with John Purcell from the PA House of Representatives, who are attending the conference. Of course, that changes things. Two detectives are slated to meet with Jeffrey Smith to talk. Now, from their perspective, they have no clue what happened at this point. But to me, it's plain and simple. She didn't find the freedom she sought, so she left. We won't have evidence that somebody abducted her from Philadelphia. No one reports her as a victim of violence. In fact, it's almost like she was never there. And the detectives think that might be the case. They think Jeffrey might be lying. So Jeffrey is asked to take a polygraph. According to him, He agreed under the condition that the FBI would get involved in the case upon receiving the results. He says that stipulation wasn't acceptable for law enforcement, and they demanded he simply take the test without any additional considerations attached. He refused, and so they painted a portrait of him as perhaps somebody with something to hide, when the reality is they wouldn't compromise. Now, when you're offered a polygraph because you're under suspicion, some people, or even a lot of people, will tell you to never take it because you have nothing to gain. Jeffrey tried to leverage a situation in which doing so would be worth it to him, but they balked. In my eyes, Jeffrey has acted like an innocent man from the start. He'll even go on to hire 2 private investigators to search for his wife. From contacting the concierge, to riding the Philly Flash, to trying to file a police report, to getting the mayor of Philly involved, and even somebody from the House of Representatives, it's more than apparent Jeffrey Smith wasn't trying to sweep a crime under the rug. But he remained under suspicion for the fact statistics show that most women who disappear under strange circumstances involving foul play are victims of someone they know. So, detectives get looking for Judy. But here's what we need to know. If Judy was unhappy in her marriage and also suffering mental illness, what is the emotional value present when the Philly Flash doesn't take her to freedom at the Liberty Bell or Independence Hall, and by extension of that, when crossing the bridge into New Jersey, doesn't take her to the greener emotional grass on the other side? What does it say if she leaves the hotel physically, looking for emotional freedom, can't find it anywhere, and is scheduled to return to the hotel? Quite literally, it says she's going back to her husband. She's returning to her life with Jeffrey. It signifies going back to that existence in which she was suffering. And she can't do that. That's what she's trying to escape by seeking freedom here. Detectives learn of a woman matching her description who stayed at the Society Hill Hotel in the area where Judy would have been riding the bus. And this person is said to have been exhibiting signs of acute mental illness, in the sense that when confronted about not paying for her room, she claimed the emperor was sending money to take care of it, and also offered some other nonsensical things. So, it's soon learned this woman was spotted elsewhere in the area, but the investigation reveals it was someone homeless who just looked like Judy, but was not in fact her. Multiple other sightings in the vicinity proved to be similar accounts of the same woman. However, both police and her family come to believe this was not her, based upon the information provided by witnesses. Now, where it gets interesting is that one homeless man, when shown Judy's picture and also a photo of the homeless woman along with that, says that he's sure he saw Judy sleeping on a bench the night of April 10th. And for me, while it can't be proven, that sounds legitimate. I'm buying it. And why? Look where she refused to return at the end of the day. The hotel. And we're going to learn that she didn't have enough money to spend on another place to stay, as far as we know. So she wouldn't go back to her husband or even that life. In essence, she became homeless. She ran away from home and even left her stuff behind. All of it. She left everything behind. So finding her asleep on a bench isn't surprising to me because she has nothing now. But we still need to definitively place her in New Jersey as having crossed the metaphorical bridge and arrived in a place she thought would offer freedom, but still doesn't. So detectives aren't learning anything definitive here in terms of what might have happened to Judy. But soon enough, information comes from a witness at a retail store at the Deptford Mall in New Jersey right across the bridge. This woman is certain that she helped the person she sees in the picture, Judy Smith. And this time, it seems legitimate. Not only does the clerk suggest the woman said she was shopping for her daughter, but that the daughter often disliked what she bought. Judy's daughter says that happened with them a lot. Her mother would persist in buying clothes for her that she didn't like. But that's not exactly a specific identifying factor. It's just a commonality with the event. Yet, that's when the witness mentions the woman was wearing a red backpack. The family says Judy wore that red backpack everywhere. So this seems to be her. So we have every reason to believe she crossed that bridge, as I said. Now, this is the last sighting of her, and it seems to be legit. But it doesn't tell us anything about where she's going. However, we do get one interesting detail here. Nuance is key to understanding what might have happened because our behavior dictates the potential range of responses we'll receive from others. The last thing the retail store clerk tells the detectives is that she watched the woman, presumably Judy, leave the store, and on her way out, she began talking to a younger woman, whom the employee assumed was likely the daughter Judy mentioned. But it quickly becomes apparent this is not her daughter, and that Judy is simply requesting the younger woman leave with her. To me, this whole event seems like a flight of fancy, a mental breakdown from suppressed emotional turmoil. Judy has been married 3 times. She's unhappy, not in the best physical shape, and with a man who has failing health. I think she was overwhelmed. She's hit middle age, failed at 3 marriages, and probably doesn't know what to do. Except run. Sometimes it feels like that's the only thing left to do. So you try to get away. One detective suggested that while Jeffrey Smith was still under suspicion, he believed Judy's disappearance was the result of something like a midlife crisis. I'm inclined to believe the same. Without a history of documented mental illness and being middle-aged, it's probably safe to say this egg cracked from pressure over time. It was a long, slow fall, but Humpty Dumpty eventually came crashing down. To my eyes, these movements, actions, and desires speak to a manic state. I sincerely doubt Judy was the one screaming madly about the emperor's money, but when it comes to sleeping on the bench, we see the physical manifestation of her plight. She has nowhere left to go emotionally, and so refuses a physical return, making her homeless. But what we should notice here, as it pertains to Judy setting herself up for a situation in which she could be killed, is that manic people tend to indulge high-risk circumstances. Here we have Judy in the retail store approaching a young woman she doesn't know and trying to convince her to come with her. Look what that says. Judy doesn't want to travel alone. She's looking for some type of companionship. Now, if you're in a retail store and inquiring of another woman, there's not necessarily a whole lot of risk in doing so. Some young lady out shopping for clothes likely isn't a predator, especially since Judy approaches her rather than the other way around. That seems to be a safe circumstance. But it's still excessive, odd, and worse, entirely desperate. You don't make a friend by just walking up to a stranger and asking that person to leave with you. Even people who meet while drinking at a bar exchange more information than that beforehand. Yet, Jeffrey tells us his wife was a kind person, almost to a fault. He claims she wouldn't think twice about helping someone, citing an incident the year prior when Judy helped an AIDS patient who was suffering during the course of a flight. Again, look at her taking unnecessary but empathetic actions without thinking about the risks first. She just approaches the other woman, expecting the person might actually want to leave with her. What if that was a man? What if he was a predator? So you can see how the high-risk values are going to lead somewhere bad. Not only is she displaying mildly delusional behavior, something typical of a manic state, but she's also indulging unnecessary risks in a desperate attempt to satisfy her emotional desires through physical means. Now that she's abandoned her husband, she's alone, so she's looking for that someone or something that's going to make things right again. So Judy, in general, is kind to a fault, taking on risks to extend her goodwill to others. But now that she's manic like this, the desperation makes her even more vulnerable. She'll extend herself more easily, even at the initial point of contact, and also be much more trusting after that. This is a great example of why mentally ill people so often become victims or even perpetrators of violence. They're more vulnerable to high-risk encounters that lend themselves to bad choices and disastrous circumstances by way of desperation. So if Judy is not only desperate to meet someone, but also inclined to help, and acting in a manner that makes her vulnerability apparent, she'll become prey. She's setting up a situation in which a predator is going to recognize what she is. No matter what happened, this, for me, is where the mystery begins. Judy just vanishes. Jeffrey continues working with the private investigators. He proceeds to mail and fax copies of Judy's missing person flyer to hospitals all over the country. That doesn't generate any answers. But on September 7th, 1997, about 5 months after Judy's disappearance, a father and son hunting team in the Pisgah National Forest near Asheville, North Carolina, locate what they think constitutes remains of an unknown woman. By the end of that month, dental records allow investigators to conclude they've located the remains of Judy Smith. So how did she die? Well, cutting marks are found on her ribs, a very common indication that a knife or something similar was utilized in a stabbing. The bra she'd been wearing proved to have similar holes. So this death is clearly a homicide, but nobody knows who's to blame for it. Now, what they need to do is try to learn if Judy had met and traveled with anyone. Her clothing seems to indicate she not only made it to North Carolina alive, but also went on the hike of her own volition rather than being dumped there after death. Investigators say her leg bones, even while the flesh had long since decomposed from them, were still clad in jeans, thermal underwear, and hiking boots. These were not the clothes witnesses had seen her wearing in Philadelphia, nor did her husband recognize them as articles she might have owned prior to her disappearance. While the body was found in the absence of identification of any kind, a black and blue backpack at the scene contained $80 in cash, while a shirt buried close to it revealed a pocket containing another $87. Jeffrey Smith said he believed his wife was carrying approximately $200 in cash when she disappeared. So, without any further activity on their bank accounts or credit cards, it seems as though Judy Smith spent an amount that wouldn't even cover the cost of clothing. That makes us wonder how she got to North Carolina. And what it also does is suggest she might have traveled with someone who either paid for her ticket, such as on a bus or train, or she caught a ride with him, negating payment altogether. The backpack found with Judy wasn't familiar to her family, and the red one was gone, So it's believed that perhaps the new backpack might have belonged to a person with whom she traveled. A person, we assume, killed her. Now, Judy could have picked up this backpack for herself at any point along the way as part of creating her new identity. I mean, the red backpack was quite distinctive. What we can also see is that the person seemed to have no use for Judy's cash. So we know this wasn't a robbery gone wrong, or even one in which she was intentionally killed to eliminate her as a witness. The other item of interest found at the scene was a nice pair of sunglasses. But again, just like we get with the blue and black backpack and the clothes, they aren't familiar to her family. So we can't say if the backpack and sunglasses belong to Judy, but we can assert that the $167 she possessed, when compared to the original $200 she started with, would only leave her expenditures at approximately $33. You couldn't even travel to North Carolina from Philadelphia while purchasing food and drinks for that sum, let alone buy a new backpack and sunglasses. What this evidence suggests in totality is that she was traveling with someone who paid her way as a means of manipulating what he wanted out of her. At some point, when that person's ulterior motives arose, whether they were sex, murder, or even both, Judy found herself caught in a trap, a spider's web, due to indulging high-risk situations to satisfy her mania. But this much is true. If she was behaving in that manner, the most likely type of person she'd hook up with is someone like her. And if that someone is male and seeking an unsuspecting female who's desperate to not be alone, his mental illness could very well lead to something like rape or murder. And of course, we have to account for the fact that Judy, while in this manic state, whether suffering from bipolar disorder or even psychosis, could have resorted to stealing the items that we see here. So she didn't necessarily get them from someone she met. She could have stolen them somewhere, but it does seem as though she did not have the cash to purchase them herself, nor did she use any type of credit card. Now, conversely to that idea I just presented, what also could have happened is that she was hitchhiking or doing something similar as a means of traveling free of charge. If she was sleeping on a bench instead of paying for a hotel, she likely wouldn't rent a car rather than hitchhike. It's possible she found her way down to North Carolina by way of catching rides with strangers, even truck drivers, and met her fate in the form of a stranger while on the hiking trail. He might have been an opportunity killer, and this opportunity of running into a vulnerable, sick woman allowed him easy prey. But that's when we learned there were sightings of Judy in the Asheville area right after her disappearance. And these sightings are not only considered legitimate by the investigators, but are also revealing. In one instance, a clerk at a retail store suggested Judy came into shop, and they started a conversation. Judy told the woman she was from Boston and had left Philadelphia while on a trip with her husband to come to Asheville. She says she just decided to go on a whim. But think about that. While the clerk says Judy seems perfectly normal, what is entirely apparent here is that Judy doesn't seem to think there's anything odd or wrong about simply disappearing off the face of the fucking planet, leaving her husband to set off a full-blown manhunt for her involving the mayor of Philadelphia. She doesn't seem to be able to process reality. That's consistent with someone in a manic phase. They're ignorant of the mania. They believe their logic is normal. And that's exactly what makes them vulnerable. Soon after, an employee at the Biltmore Estate says she saw Judy as well. At a campground near the location where the body is found, Judy was seen driving a gray sedan full of boxes and bags. She asked if she could stay there free for the night, and when the owner refused, she drove away. So right here, look at the details. What does it look like? Vagrancy. Homelessness. And what is the Biltmore Estate? It's known as America's largest, grandest home. Look at the desires manifesting for her. She can't find an emotional home where she can be at peace through change, so she flees her physical home, refuses to go back to Jeffrey, and goes straight to the biggest, most beautiful home in the country to compensate. It's a physical move. But guess what? Like the campground, she can't stay. This isn't her home. So she keeps looking. And the tragedy of it is that nowhere physical is going to be her emotional home where she can find peace. Unless she arrives at a place where she dies. And in the end, that place, in accordance with the trajectory of her logic, becomes higher ground. This says she's going to die at higher ground. That's the end of the line. The rising emotional waters are never going to stop. There is not a physical place to escape them. So that's the only physical place left for her to go, just like it was for the woman in Oslo Plaza going to the high floor of the hotel. And she knows that. We find her in such a place and dressed for it. She chose to go. She was still searching. And if you seek peace but can't find it emotionally and are indulging physical solutions without relenting to the need to change, a physical solution in the form of tragedy will undoubtedly come to bear. And that's what happens here. Judy finds emotional peace through the physicality of death, which, again, makes this story a terrible tragedy. Now, on top of the other sightings, a deli owner nearby said Judy came into the store to buy approximately $30 worth of sandwiches and a little toy truck. But that's it. In and of itself, that information doesn't say much. But consider this a moment. Judy had $167 of $200 remaining when found deceased, as compared to what her husband said she had when she disappeared. If you consider that $30 spent on sandwiches, along with a little toy truck, in 1997, the cost of these items was likely about $33. So it seems as though Judy might not have spent any money otherwise. Yet, here she is, driving a car full of stuff, buying a toy for a child, and purchasing more sandwiches than we could reasonably expect her to eat by herself in one sitting. All of these things, from the car, to the items inside, to the toy truck, to the lack of expenditures, to the purchase of multiple sandwiches, suggest at least one other adult and a child were involved in this narrative. The only problem with that consideration is that Judy is never seen with anyone in this car. However, she's seen in the car by herself multiple times. So she had to get the car somewhere, and she didn't seem to have the cash to buy it. We could say she might have been hoarding cash at home in the absence of Jeffrey's knowledge and used that to purchase the car, but there's no record of her buying anything like that. Nobody remembers selling her a car. And also, if she had that type of money, she could have stayed wherever she wanted and traveled however she wanted. So I think that element is key. The car she's using is full of boxes and bags, which wouldn't be hers because she disappeared without as much as a suitcase and had very little money. She had only the clothes on her back. So these things are clearly somebody else's. The car, in the condition described, and given Judy's vagrancy at the time, was probably owned by another homeless person who had been living out of it. It's possible Judy had borrowed the car, whether she had permission or not. Either way, nobody else is ever seen in the car with her, and we are not able to attach her to that car by way of any type of purchase or rental. So, what I think most likely happened in this story is that Judy Smith engaged the physical manifestation of her emotional issue of needing to take flight from her psychological problem, which caused her to put herself in a situation that disallowed her to go back to the place from which she came, and also prevented her from moving forward through emotional change. She became homeless by default of that logic, searching for an emotional peace at physical locations, which is an impossibility in terms of success, and lends itself to perpetual vagrancy. Most people who are homeless got that way either directly or indirectly as a result of some type of mental illness. If Judy was using someone else's car, and it seemed to belong to a homeless person with ample possessions, unlike Judy, then we could assume the fact she's seen without the person each time she uses it, and also tries to sleep overnight in the vehicle without the owner at the campground with her, means that she took the vehicle. She stole it. One way or another, she isn't the owner, and is never spotted with whomever might be. I mean, if the car was hers, we'd find it waiting for her in the aftermath of her murder, or realize someone stole it. Yet that doesn't happen, and the most likely reason is that the car belonged to someone else. Being a homeless vagrant herself, Judy would have to find a way to get into the area in which she was hiking. The most rational explanation for how she would have arrived there is by driving that gray sedan she was seen in. Yet, it's not found near the scene, or ever reported stolen in relation to Judy. What seems most likely to me is that Judy simply took someone else's car to head to higher ground desperately, and it was a homeless man she met. What seems most likely to me is that Judy simply commandeered someone else's car to desperately head to higher ground, without thinking of the consequences. It was probably a homeless man she met, and she just simply took the car for her own use without thinking about what might happen, like I said. Again, we never see anyone else in the vehicle with her, but it's full of someone else's stuff, and she's trying to do an overnight trip in it. Where is the owner? This is probably everything the poor bastard owns. And again, if he's homeless, he's likely mentally ill as well. I think this person might have let her borrow the car once or twice with permission, meaning such as the time she went to get the sandwiches in the little toy truck, like, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And Judy eventually just decided she was going to make that car work for her like she did when changing the flight. She was going to do it alone, just like she did when she took off from the Philly Flash. So I think, as she did before, she just took off on this person, like she did to her husband, without remorse, but also without malice. She's manic, on autopilot, perhaps even psychotic by then. I think the killing was probably revenge for taking the car. And the reason the cash was still at the scene is that what the person wanted returned was the car and all of his stuff. The owner of the car, a mentally ill man Judy had met along her journey of vagrancy and homelessness, became a victim of her desires, just like her husband. But in that case, he lost everything. With Jeffrey, Judy left it all behind. With this guy, when she took the car, she took the entirety of his life with her. But again, like Judy, this man is probably also unstable, and mentally ill men have a greater propensity for violence. If you're a homeless vagrant suffering mental illness and traveling, the most likely type of person you're going to meet and have interactions with are traveling homeless vagrants like you. Of course, what would be a popular version of that type of person? A man living out of his car. Probability suggests Judy Smith was killed by a mentally ill homeless man. If she was seen repeatedly in a car she didn't own and couldn't afford, along with boxes and bags of stuff she didn't have the time to compile, we understand that car belonged to someone else. But although we have multiple witness sightings of her in the car, we never have an account of her being in the car with another person. It's just Judy. So I think she took the car, and I think the person from whom she stole it caught up with her face to face, took the keys, and killed her as punishment. Otherwise, that car should still be around when Judy is discovered. I mean, we don't have a witness suggesting they gave her a ride to go on this hiking trip. She had to get there somehow. The answer is most likely by way of the car she drove. And that car is nowhere to be found in the aftermath. We have to ask why that is. Nobody ever finds this car with all that stuff inside. When she's gone, the car is too. That's the key for my assessment. Witnesses can account for Judy being alive and well leading up to the sightings of her in that car. But she ends up dead right afterward. And when she's gone, the car follows. It disappears too. One would think, if it was hers, it would remain sitting in a place after her death that would eventually lead investigators to it. Whether the registration expired, or it had none, or even if it was parked somewhere, it had to be moved. But that doesn't happen. And that situation isn't organic. Nobody can tie Judy to another person being in that car, which is odd if it belongs to someone else. And again, if she purchased it, a seller would know that happened. But no one comes forward. The car and Judy Smith suddenly disappear at once. Not only that, but Judy vanishes in a place in which she would have had to have driven to get there. There's no public transportation to that spot. You need a car. And she had one, and was seen near that area in it. It was confirmed by more than one witness, and on more than one occasion. So what happened to that car, and where was its owner? I think that person who owned the car, whether legally or not, came back to get it. I think he found her. The state of the body doesn't suggest sexual assault. The pants and thermal underwear are still on the legs. The boots are still on the feet. So if you stabbed a woman to death in the absence of a sexual motive, then what would be the reason? Normally, a killing of that sort, if not motivated by sex, is driven by some type of revenge for being wronged. Think about this. If Judy was supposed to take flight with her husband on the same plane, and then manipulated a situation in which she actually took off on her own, by herself? Then what do you think transpired with the car's owner when Judy decided to flee to higher ground in it? Like Jeffrey, he got left behind, and with no warning at all. Yet, unlike Jeffrey, a stable, empathetic individual, the car's owner would be unstable. And again, Judy leaves everything behind when she leaves Jeffrey. But when she leaves this guy behind, she takes everything he owns with her. And so that is the basis for the difference in the reaction. She went to the well one more time, but she no longer had a husband whose life she could leave behind. This time, she had to take someone's life with her, because the car was the means that she would use to get to higher ground. And so, in doing that, she took everything from this person who had so little to begin with. And I think that's the key here. Now, the serial killer angle is always the sexy choice, but it's usually total bullshit. As soon as a podcaster hears a serial killer was active in the area, even within a decade or two decade long window, they start reeling off all the details to try to make it a good fit. I won't do that to you now. I do not see a serial killer who fits this profile perfectly. I think it's a reach. Nor is there one who operated at this time in this specific manner and without conflicts arising that would suggest they're not guilty. The overwhelming majority of people who are murdered fall victim to somebody they know. I think Judy knew her killer, and that he was a homeless vagrant like herself, specifically the owner of the car she borrowed or stole, evidenced by her never being seen with anyone. That type of relationship with a man living out of his car would be the equivalent of her marriage now that she's a homeless vagrant. Quite simply, Judy took off, and in the same way Jeffrey followed her trail along the Philly Flash route, intuitively knowing she disappeared during that time, I think the owner of the car was finally able to track her down on the hiking trail after she took off with his shit. The hill was so steep where Judy's body was found that detectives claim it would be extremely difficult for anyone to carry her up there. So, she wasn't dumped. This is a woman who had already been through two divorces. Unless she had some type of mental breakdown from a manic episode like you'd see in somebody bipolar, or even descended into psychosis, she'd likely just tell her husband she wanted a divorce. It's not like it would be more difficult this time. Judy simply has no reason to take off running from a man like Jeffrey. He isn't abusive or stalking her, and has no history of doing anything like that in their marriage. There's no reason to fear him or his reaction if you say you're leaving. He's been through a divorce before as well. He knows things can fall apart. So if Judy wasn't running from him, the only thing left to fear is what's in her head. That's what she was running from. Given the condition of the car she was seen driving, meaning full of bags and boxes, that person who owned it was in a similar place emotionally. I think they found each other, and the event was a collision course for tragedy. No homeless person, or even any other citizen, has come forward to say, "Hey, she was driving my car. I knew her. Or I sold her that car." The car is a complete mystery. So is the identity of its owner. And so is Judy's death. Everything else in this case can be validated in some manner or another. only those elements remain unanswered. The car's origin, its owner, and where it went after the killing. My sense is that the killing involved a dispute with that person. Thus, no information in relation to the car became available because that's the one witness who can't talk. That's the information we don't know. So I believe the answers to those questions offer the truth. Some people have suggested the vehicle could have been a rental car, but you need to show ID to rent a car. You also have to offer a credit card for the charges. There would be a paperwork trail and a witness who rented it when she arrived. They'd see her. She'd have to be given keys and return them later with the vehicle. Nothing like that is reported to have happened. So Judy was dressed for hiking, and her body was found in an area conducive to that, 12 miles outside of Asheville. If she wasn't dumped there and went there on her own, she didn't get to that place on foot. Yet, she left behind no vehicle in the parking area associated with the nearest trails, nor did the police find any other abandoned car nearby. It seems as though she walked all the way from Asheville. That is, unless someone took the same car upon leaving that she arrived in earlier. If she had possession of the car and they wanted it back, they would have to confront her face to face on the hike and threaten her in a way she'd comply. Because, obviously, she'd be holding the keys. They wouldn't be in the car. Now, a knife would do the job in threatening her. But if anything went wrong, or if she refused, or even if the car's owner just lost control from being disrespected like that, an argument could lead to murder. Either way, if you caught up to her that day, again, you'd have to get the keys in person. You couldn't just take the car. Unless you had an extra set, but then again, she would still have the keys and could take the car back. So the most effective move is to confront her and threaten her to get your keys back. Judy probably took the car and left town without a word, but 12 miles wasn't far enough to avoid trouble. The person learned where she was and finally caught up to her to get the car back. Yes, it's highly speculative, but again, when examining this evidence, there's a clear narrative of Judy not only taking flight with no regard for others, but the situation with the car also yields mystery from start to finish that can't be explained. If the car's owner is the only person for whom we can't account, and we're unable to determine what happened to the vehicle Judy used to get to the location of where she was murdered and the campground just before that, then we understand the car and its owner offer a very high probability of involvement in this case. Given that Judy was seen driving the car alone multiple times and there's nothing attaching her to it in any way, my assessment is that she borrowed the car under false pretenses and never returned. Another homeless vagrant type would be less inclined to call the police or report the car stolen. Who knows if it was registered? Did it have insurance? Probably not. It looks like someone was living out of it. So, like Judy, he might have been involved in some shady stuff and couldn't go to the police. Now, I'm absolutely certain of everything I've asserted up to the point of the disappearance and the reason for Judy seeking higher ground in North Carolina. But beyond that, to the best I can tell, the missing answer to the riddle of who killed her and why lies with the identity of the car's owner. It's the missing link. I think the car she was driving simply belonged to someone else, and under false pretenses, when she took off, seeking higher ground in the mountains, like she did to her husband on the Philly trip, seeking freedom by way of the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, that mentally ill person she swindled looked to get it back and get revenge on her. If you recall, her husband followed her trail on the Philly Flash when she took off. Put that event in the context of the car owner following her trail to find her. If you did something like that to the wrong person, you could pay the ultimate price. I believe that's what happened. The motive isn't robbery or sexual assault leading to murder. It seems to be a killing that occurred in the absence of those elements. Given that scenario, I can only conclude Judy Smith knew her killer and that the person was the unknown owner of a mysterious gray sedan full of bags and boxes that was not only reclaimed after the crime, but never identified for that reason. Money was left behind. Judy's jewelry was also ignored. Her pants were still on. If you consider the $30 purchase of sandwiches and a toy truck, she probably earned the trust of a small group of homeless people by providing meals and a toy for one of their children in exchange for borrowing the car. Soon, though, she took off, and it was apparent she was manipulating them just like she'd done to her husband Jeffrey, because they, in the form of their car, were a conduit to freedom. The car took her to higher ground. It was more important than the person who owned it, in the same way taking off alone was more important than being with her husband. All she cared about was the physical goal. It was very risky. We see that risk starting from the get-go in the story. Judy was really desperate. There are only so many high-risk behaviors you can indulge before that barking dog decides to bite. And when it does, if you fuck with the wrong person, well, sometimes you pay the price. I don't see a result in which anything other than Judy's high-risk behavior and badly compromised logic created a deadly cocktail. There was an evil person on the end of that knife, but I think she put herself in that situation. Nobody finds a receipt of purchase for the gray sedan at a later date, nor do they learn it's rented. When Judy goes, so goes the mysterious car she'd only been seen driving alone. And it happens right after the incident in which she stops at the campground in the car to ask if she can stay the night. She's clearly on a journey. She was heading to higher ground at that point, driving outside of Asheville and up to the campground. She only has $167 on her and leaves the campground because she can't pay to park there for the night by renting a whole spot. If she can't even afford to do that, how in the world would she have rented a car or even bought one? It's impossible. When she arrived at that campground that night, I think she had just made her break to higher ground by taking the car in the same way she took off from Jeffrey at the hotel seeking freedom. She tried to find freedom. It failed. She tried to find a bridge to the other side where the grass was greener, but it really wasn't. And finally, realizing she was drowning and out of options, Judy sought higher ground. That gray sedan never caused suspicion otherwise, meaning in the aftermath of the murder, it disappeared as though it was being operated by its proper owner. If Judy was the only person witnessed driving it, and then it was gone, very suddenly, someone took it. And if that happened, and it wasn't the owner, somebody would report it. So what I see is that Judy took that car from its owner. He then found her. An argument ensued. It escalated. Or he might have just attacked her out of rage. We see anger in this killing. The jewelry isn't important. The cash isn't either. The body is in a remote place, but not concealed or buried. And the murder weapon is a knife. I think she knew this person, and it was somebody unstable she met in North Carolina. This was personal, stemming from a perceived slight or wrongdoing, I assume, is taking the car. I'm guessing Judy rationalized the event as her borrowing the car when she really just took off without mentioning anything like she did to her husband. If you recall the insight into her thought process we previously got from the retail clerk, in which Judy casually told her that she just decided on a whim to leave her trip with Jeffrey in Philly to go to North Carolina, then you understand what I mean. She didn't think that was a big deal. It even seemed reasonable enough to admit to a stranger without any shame. Meanwhile, her husband is frantically searching for her. I think she took that same disposition into stealing the car, and it got her killed. She might have been intending to bring it back eventually, in the same way she might have returned to her husband and home life eventually. But these are high-risk behaviors because the people on the other end of these manipulations are real. If a wife goes missing, her husband is going to look for her. But he won't be doing it in anger. He'll think she's hurt or lost or anything along those lines. It will be done with empathy, until which point, if ever, it's proven she took off to escape him and really wanted to get away. And that's when empathy will turn to anger. But not until then. Meanwhile, the same thing goes for the car. If Judy says something like, "Oh, can I borrow the car to go get more sandwiches today?" there will be empathy for this person because of her generosity, and you'll allow her to use the car. But when she doesn't return, the empathy turns to anger because you realize you were manipulated, and in the wrong hands, that anger can turn deadly. If she was hanging around the homeless, which is well illustrated by her car full of junk, the mentally ill were undoubtedly among them. So that's my call. She was murdered by a vagrant, not unlike herself at the time. I think she broke someone else's trust, without remorse, like she did to Jeffrey, and paid because when she left Jeffrey, everything was left behind, yet with the homeless person, she took everything he owned with her. We have opposing values there. There's a difference in the sense of loss. Everything about this tale indicates tragedy stemming from acute mental illness. Judy Smith was desperate, and in the process of indulging risks, she took it a step too far. This happens to mentally ill people quite often. They meet like-minded people, and sometimes, while they share the same illness, some are violent and others are not. Judy was vulnerable, trusting, and looking to help. She met the wrong man. I have a feeling her husband, on some level, knew she was this person. It's not like she left him for a better guy and a better life. Judy was clearly living the life of a drifter, a vagrant, a homeless woman. That was something she chose for herself. If we examine the theme of this tale, what it tells us is that she seemed to be looking for freedom from everything. The focus is placed on the context being her leaving her husband, but in truth, she leaves her entire life behind, not just Jeffrey. It's not like she's contacting family and friends. No one knows what happened to her. In the end, of course, nobody deserves such a fate, regardless of their behavior. The evidence doesn't offer any strong suggestions of sexual assault, and jewelry and cash were left behind by the assailant, whom we know was not in a rush because he partially buried some of these things. He didn't take off running, which might explain the presence of those items. Instead, items of value are left at the scene. The cash can't be connected to her. Why not take it? The only answer we know is true is that the killer didn't want it. To me, that speaks to a rage killing or a revenge killing. Repeated stab wounds would satisfy that desire. I think it was a confrontation with someone she knew, an altercation gone wrong. Either way, it was a horrifying manner in which to meet her fate. So I sincerely hope that justice, perhaps one day, will prevail. And for Jeffrey Smith, he went to his grave in 2005, never quite knowing the truth. In the end, what remains with me about this story is the nature of Judy's journey. In our own way, we are all descending into madness while looking for something we can never quite find and never truly seem to have a home where we can stay forever. But as we travel this road of life, endlessly seeking our truth, searching for the light up ahead, our legs become weary, our hearts hardened by the passage of time and the tragedy of continuing to create in the face of imminent loss. We will still never stop believing that a place exists where everything is going to be okay. And though we may travel different paths to arrive at that eternal peace, when we can go no farther, we will suddenly realize that was exactly the thing we'd been looking for all along. And for just a brief moment, we can run again. With hope. With terror. Toward the future. Toward the sun. To the finish line. Where the beauty of silence awaits.